All right, you guys, listen, it's not quite 4:30, but you did well. Let's keep going. So let's plow some ground here before supper, and we'll be back one after. Now listen, again, these are the days. Let me just rehearse this real quickly for you, why I call it this. Sunday is a day of messianic presentation in the sense that it was the triumphal entry, and it was the moment of official. Remember, I didn't really make much of this, but remember what that verse says, Daniel 9 says, from the going forth of the commandment unto Messiah the Prince. And the day that King Messiah most officially offered himself to Israel was that Sunday. Now, I asked the question, given Sunday, why Friday? Given the fact that they were so anxious to receive him on Sunday, why are they crying for his crucifixion on Friday? And I always say, if that's the question, given Sunday, why Friday, I think the answer is Monday and Tuesday. And that's what I'm going to develop very quickly, because Monday and Tuesday are days of messianic proclamation. And in a way that may not be immediately familiar to our ears and soul spirits, but would have been compelling and unmistakable to a Jewish audience, Jesus lays the truth concerning himself before that city and drives them to a decision. And I would submit to you, and I'll try and develop this quickly in just a few moments, that by means of these 2 days, which must be taken together, Monday, Tuesday, days of messianic proclamation, when Jesus leaves the city of Jerusalem late on Tuesday afternoon for the last time, it's the last time he'll leave under his own power, and returns to Bethany, he has driven the city to a decision. And that decision is going to percolate, if you don't mind, in their soul spirit, and they'll cast their vote on Friday morning. What's going to happen is when they awake on Friday morning, they must have been absolutely shocked to find out that this Nazarene, whom they had welcomed so delightfully earlier in the week, was on trial for his life. But I'll come back to that. Then, Wednesday, as I say, is a silent day. I'll talk about that in just a minute. Thursday afternoon, Jesus sends Peter and John to prepare the upper room, and then he takes his disciples and spends time in the upper room, and clearly that's a time of preparation of his disciples. He's preparing them for what's to happen. And then later that night, he leaves very abruptly and takes them out to a place called Gethsemane, and there he prepares his own soul spirit. So it's at that level that Thursday, and the two events of Thursday are the upper room and then Gethsemane, and he is preparing first the disciples and then himself. And then, of course, Friday, as he emerges from the garden, very, very late on Thursday, maybe early Friday morning, Judas shows up with the soldiers and arrests Jesus, and he is tried, and by 9 o'clock he is on a cross, and after 6 hours of unspeakable suffering, he cries, "It is finished." And so in that sense, he perfects the work that the Father had sent him to do. And then his body is laid in a tomb, and you remember we've said that the way God proves true, the truth of a man's claim to be a divine messenger is miracle, and the greatest miracle is the resurrection. And Romans 1, he was declared. It's in that sense I'm using the word pronounced. He was horizoned, as we said, to be the Son of God by the resurrection from the dead. So those are the successive days. I want us to think about Monday and Tuesday, and I'm going to have to, you know, number one, we ought to think of these two together. There's a lot going on here. I love these 2 days. I often say that if you came to me with one free ride on your newly invented time machine, I think I'd probably dial up Monday and Tuesday. These are staggering, staggering days, but we're going to have to shortchange them because I just haven't managed my time well. So let me take you through it quickly. And this is on your notes, but I'm going to walk you through the narrative. I want to get somewhere. You know that as he returns to the city, he discovers the fig tree. I wish we had the time, but let me just say this. If you read this story in Matthew, it sounds for all the world like it happened all on Tuesday morning. When you read it in Mark, it is unmistakably clear that there were actually 2 days at stake. As he came in on Monday morning, he saw the fig tree and cursed it. And then as he returned on Tuesday morning by the same route, coming from Bethany to the Temple Mount, they discovered the tree to have withered from its roots up. Now, I'd love to do this with you, but I can't take the time. But let me just challenge you to do this. Folks, let me say this. You know that there's a whole community of so-called scholars who live to discredit the Bible. And their happy hunting ground is the Gospels, because you got four guys telling the same stories. So they just go through that with a fine-tooth comb, trying to find those places. And one of the places they'll say is, Matthew makes it absolutely clear that it happened on Tuesday morning in his telling, whereas Mark puts, and remember I talked to you about the redaction criticism, remember I talked about that, that has seeped in the evangelical world. A lot of evangelicals will say, well, yeah, perhaps, maybe one of them's mistaken, but it's not that big a deal. We know for sure that a tree was withered. No, you can't begin. But this is my challenge to you, and I'm going to leave it here. Read carefully this twofold account in the book of Mark, and then read carefully the same account in the book of Matthew. If you carelessly read Matthew, it can be read to have happened all on one day, but Matthew never says that. And there is nothing about the way Matthew tells the story which is inconsistent with the way Mark tells the story. But I will say this, that when you read the story in Mark, it's going to inform your reading of the story in Matthew, so you some initial impressions you might realize were wrong, but it's not what Matthew says at all. Does that make sense to you? For instance, he says that he tells the story of the triumphal entry. That's Sunday. No, I'm sorry. This may be confusing to you. Matthew tells the story of the cleansing of the temple. That's Monday. And then after that, he says, and it was morning, and Jesus entered the city and saw the tree. So many people say, well, he said it was the morning after. No, he did not. What he is telling you is this. The Jewish people don't begin the day with a meal. It's much like what we think of as Mexico. You know, you have the kind of the siesta in the middle of the day. That's exactly. They begin the day early, up before the sun, out in the fields, working as in the cool of the morning. And when the sun gets hot, they go in and have a meal. So they would often snack as they began their day. Does that make sense to you? And it's for that reason that Matthew simply says it was morning. He's not saying it was the next morning. It doesn't say that. It just says it was morning, to set the scene for why it is that Jesus was interested in that fig tree. See, the fig bears two crops of fruit every year in Palestine. But, well, in Israel. I shouldn't say Palestine, although that's a more innocuous term. But anyway, in that region. And the winter fruit is gnarly and worthless. And so you're welcome. This is somebody's fig tree. It's a domesticated, harvestable fig tree. But you're welcome to just take that winter fig and find what little meat you can and eat it. It's a good snack. The summer fruit is harvested in the fall, and you'd be a thief if you took summer fruit, but this is winter fruit. It's spring. Does that make sense to you? And so the point is that Matthew is simply saying, as was their habit, it was morning, and so they would often snack. You know, another thing they do sometimes is take grain and rub it in their hands and take some of the, remember when the disciples did that and got in trouble for doing it on the Sabbath and so on? So all I'm saying to you is that, again and again, this is the case, that the critic who wants to find errors in the Scripture reads what he wants to into a passage, even though it may not be what the passage is explicitly saying. The passage could just as well be read to be entirely consistent with the parallel passage. That's certainly the case here. But the critic who wants to find an error announces, and then, you know, well, we found an incontrovertible error. And for generations, for centuries, it has been the impulse of Bible believers to say, hold on here, let's go, let's check, and work at harmonizing. Does that make sense? But today, the whole evangelical world is saying, well, I guess you're right, but so what? You know, maybe the details are wrong. Can you tell? It drives me crazy. I didn't mean to get off on it. But I think, by the way, what happened is he curses the fig. He comes. All right, very quickly. The fig tree bears a winter, gnarly, unusable fruit, and then after that fruit comes a summer blossom. So when Jesus sees the tree with leaves, he deduces that there should be fruit. When he gets there, he discovers that it's evidently not a healthy fig tree, and it has no winter fruit, and so he pronounces a curse. I think the point is that he sees in that fig tree such a remarkable picture of the people of Israel, because yesterday he had ridden in, and the whole city was anxious to welcome him as king. That's the leaves, but by the end of the week, they're going to be crying for his blood. That's the lack of any fruit. That makes sense to you, and I think it's at that point that he uses it as a picture. Well, but then Jesus comes and he cleanses the temple. Now, I could say a lot about this. I'm going to be as quick as I know how. This is so big. Folks, I would like, here is a drawing by Lane Rittmeyer of what's called the Second Temple, Herod's Temple. Remember that in their history, the Jews had two temples. The first was built by whom? Solomon, destroyed by Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, 586. The second, here's a go to the head of the class question, was built by Zerubbabel. It was a squatty little affair. It was a horrible disappointment. Those who were old enough to remember Solomon's temple wept with sorrow when they saw this little temple. But, remember there were two prophets who encouraged them to get busy with temple building, Haggai and Zechariah, and they promised that the glory of this latter house would be greater than the glory of the former house. And in point of fact, about 40 years before Jesus, Herod the Great, was induced to reconstruct their temple. And he took that poor little Hasmonean temple, Zerubbabel's temple, which actually had been upgraded a bit by the Hasmoneans, and he turned it into one of the most remarkable structures on the face of the earth. People came from around the world. Time for this one. Herod's a fascinating guy because he, number one, he was one of the greatest geniuses in human history for what he did. Now, how much of it was his own work, but I mean, see, remember I told you that Jezreel Valley was the most important valley on the face of the earth? The reason was because it's the only narrow spot on the most important international trunk route. And if you could control that valley, you could tax those caravans coming through that valley. Herod did that. He got so wealthy in this Pax Romana. At the very time in history when under the Roman peace, trade was exploding, he happened to possess the most lucrative toll gate on the face of the earth. And he made full proof of it. And he generated so much money, he couldn't get rid of it. And with it, he attracted all of these people from all over the world, all of these artisans who came and engaged in these remarkable... And when you go to Israel, isn't it true, Kirk? All you talk about is Herod, seems like. Everywhere you go, he just left his fingerprints all over the land because of these monumental, and perhaps his grandest, well, you know, he built the Roman officer, whoever he was, Herod or Pilate in Jesus' ministry, Herod at the time of Jesus' birth, Pilate at the time of Jesus' ministry, did not live in Jerusalem. They lived in Caesarea, which was a beautiful city that Herod had crafted. And in order to have a city, see, he wanted to be a muscled-up Roman officer, an important member of the club. But he was assigned to this two-bit, third-rate, backwater, third-world little province, parochial province called Palestine at the time. And well, it wasn't called Palestine, called Judea, actually. But it was he got the whole area. But he wanted to transform it into a noble Roman province. And in order to do that, he had to have a harbor. You ever thought about this? The Jews have a huge shoreline they never went to sea. Phoenicians, all throughout history, they went to sea. The Jews never went to sea. Now, I think that was in the providence of God, but do you know physically why that is? Pardon? They had no harbor. It's all that silt that pours out of the Nile River every year gets swept right along there and they have this long, smooth beach. And if you don't have some sort of a natural harbor where the boats can pull inside and if the storm comes, they're not going to be dashed, they won't come in there. And they never had a harbor. And Herod knew that he could. And plus, I'll tell you what else, I shouldn't get lost in this, but there's a huge spice trade coming up right through Israel, but they either went up to Tyre or down to Alexandria. And again, he lost all of that spice trade, all of the commerce and the tolls and so on. So if he could have a harbor, he could be a muscled-up Roman province and he could capture all of that spice trade, which he did. He's the first man-made harbor. He found a concrete that would set up underwater, had it shipped in, built these big molds and trained guys to, set the harbor up and then drop it and set the molds up and attach ballast and so on. I don't know. But anyway, this is his other grand achievement. Now, there are others, but I think these are the two. And this is the temple. Now, I'd love to talk about it. Let me just say that in order to build this marvelous, this temple is about 35 acres. You can put over 250,000 people in there at once. The city of David was, I think, 17 acres. The whole city that David captured, the only city he ever ruled over, was like half the size of this Temple Mount. You remember the city of David is down here to the south, and here's the Mount of Olives on the east. This is the Fortress Antonia on the north. But this vast temple mount, what happened is the city of David was down here, and right here underneath this building was a little threshing floor belonged to a man named Arapnah. And David bought that threshing floor, remember, after a plague had been stopped there. And then he brought the ark up there, and then Solomon built the temple up there. But it was just a little knob of a hill. And Herod wanted to turn it into this vast platform, and so in order to do that, he had to build this system of retaining walls right here. This whole, in other words, the temple are these pilasters, this and up, but this is actually, it's making sense to you, you got a little hill and you want a huge plaza, so you got to build this big sandbox and then put the plaza on top. And he built this huge system, and it's there today. When you walk around on the Temple Mount, Kirk was there a couple months ago, and you guys, now everything is gone, but you're walking around in that airspace. That same structure is still there. Of course, there is a hideous, forgive me, but I call it a pimple on the face of the earth called the Dome of the Rock, which is right here. And then there's another mosque that sits down here. By the way they constructed this, there were 15 grand steps, and those steps are still there. Some of them are there. You can walk on those steps today. Why 15? You remember? The Psalms of Ascent. Remember Psalm 120 through 134? 15 psalms which God built into the Psalter to prepare your heart to approach Him. And so you would stop on each one of these steps and recite one of those psalms. Then you'd go another one and recite those psalms and prepare yourself. And then the primary entrance was here, and it was underground. You go under here, and there was a lavish system of tunnels and steps, and so you would emerge here. That's what that's representing. But Josephus says that all of this was arranged so that as you went through those subterranean tunnels, I guess most tunnels are subterranean, but you know, if you're going through the tunnels, your eyes dilate. There are torches in there, but your eyes get big. And then as you emerge here, of course, this is east, and the sun is in the south behind you, and you have this 90-foot building with all overlaid with ivory and gold and the sun bouncing off of it. And Josephus says it would almost physically knock you over. You would stagger. And of course, that was appropriate because this is where God lives. And so the whole thing was crafted to make its impact. I'll tell you something. I'll come back to this tomorrow morning. This whole system was designed by God. I mean, all of these accoutrements and so on were much more Herodian than they were, God. But God, providence to be sure. But this is not what's commanded in the scriptures. But it answers to everything, but it adds to it. But this whole system was designed to assault your physical senses. When you went to temple, we always think of the temple as this grand, beautiful, cathedral-like place. In fact, it was a slaughterhouse. Tens of thousands of lambs being slain every day. Kind of an interesting thing. Here's the Mount of Olives. We're up on the Temple Mount. There's a deep valley between this mount and that mount there. It's called the Valley Kidron. That Valley Kidron becomes a Nahal, which is a riverbed. And it makes its way all the way to the Dead Sea, which is hugely important because all of this had to be drained. And there was a huge system of cisterns and fountains and channels and conduits and so on. And constantly it was all being carefully drained into the Kidron Valley. And there was a brook that ran all the way down to that Dead Sea, seven times the salt content of normal salt water, to entirely wash that sewage away. God provided a remarkable system of cleansing this entire area. This right here, just to make a point, you see, when this temple was destroyed in 70 AD by the Romans, almost all of it was pushed into this valley. So much so that valley has been filled up. And today, this is the Western Wall. This is the Wailing Wall. In other words, you'll stand at the Western Wall and you're this far above. And by the way, these are people. These are shops down here, just to give you some sense of the size you're talking here. These are people walking around down here. And this is about 70 feet. It's about 70 feet between where today's... Oh, quit it. Where today's walkway is and where the walkway was in Jesus' day. It's now, I lost myself entirely, didn't I? Here's the thing. This temple was composed of this temple complex. There was an outer court called the Court of the Gentiles. And then you would go past a little balustrade and through these gates, and you'd be in what was called the Court of the Women. Court of the Gentiles was as far as a Gentile could go. Proselyte, anybody interested in Yahweh, knowing the God of Israel. But, as a matter of fact, this little balustrade here, this little, it was like a fence, and you could step over it, but every so many feet there was an inscription that said, let any Gentile know that he will, if he passes this point, he'll be responsible for the death he will most certainly suffer, or something like that. They found two of them, and they're called Thanatos inscriptions, or death inscriptions, because of that. But at any rate, then they would make their way into the Court of Israel, and beyond that, you would make your way through this gate, in the Court of the Women, beyond that, into what was called the Court of Israel. Now, and that's where the actual sacrifices were made, and only adult Jewish men were allowed there. Now, the point is that this grand, again, now we're looking from a different perspective. We're looking from the Mount of Olives down. This is the temple itself. Here is the Court of the Women, and beyond it is the Court of Israel. But this is the Court of the Gentiles. I want you to get some feel for it. Here's a looking down. This is a model, by the way, if you don't be troubled by that. This vast area here is, and these porches on the outside, this is the royal porch, and this is Solomon's porch. Remember how the Christians early on would meet at these stoa, these covered areas that were designed for that. Now, all that to say that, by the way, I wanted to point something out to you, then I'll come back to it. See this right here, this bridge? This is actually a bridge. It looks like a wall, but it's a bridge. And it goes from the wealthy area over here into the Temple Mount. So file that away. Now, the point is that, now I'm going to tell a story quickly here. The Passover was the feast at which more people came than any other feast. And when you came, you had to bring a lamb. Now, you didn't have to, raise the lamb, but you had to buy a lamb, or you had to bring a lamb that was a year old and without blemish and so on. And after you brought the lamb, you had to present it to the priests. Now, at this time, let me see if I've got it here. Let me ask you to do this. Have you got a place where you can write down? A little motor activity won't hurt anybody here. This is the short course. I'd love to give you more, but when you encounter the New Testament, these two predominant groups, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, it's important, especially at this time and what we're talking about right here, to understand the distinction. So I'll give you first of all the Pharisee, and if you'll just write it out that way, I don't have this in your notes, but if you can find a spot somewhere, or just follow along, do whatever you want, but I'm trying to distinguish the Pharisees from the Sadducees very, very simply, and I will absolutely stand by this. I know there's a lot of discussion about this. I've tried to stay abreast of the discussion, but I'm totally unconvinced. I this is the standard understanding, and I'm convinced of it. The Pharisees, basically, their area of influence was the synagogue. Now, the point is simply that there were synagogues everywhere. Do you understand that? There could be only one temple. The temple is where sacrifices were made, but somewhere in the intertestamental period, the Jews began to develop this idea of a gathering place, a synagoge, and there were synagogues everywhere, and it was a place where you gather primarily to study the scriptures and so on, but also for some prayer. No sacrifice went on at the synagogue. You could not have a synagogue without a copy of the Torah. And you couldn't go down to the Barnes & Noble to buy your Torah, right? You had to hire a scribe. You had to hire him. You had to support a scribe so he could produce a Torah for you. And those scribes, and that was a very, very carefully, you spent a lot of years studying and preparing to be a scribe. And they had a lifetime devotion to the Torah. And they were almost all entirely committed to the Pharisaic understanding of the Torah. So the point is that in a very non-official but real sense, the Pharisees controlled the synagogue. Secondly, I'd say there as to their religious, they believed the entire law. As a matter of fact, they also believed their traditions, the oral laws. And that's what got them into trouble, and I'd love to talk about it, but just suffice it to say that they were committed to the entire law. And thirdly, as to their standing with the common man, get this, this is huge. They were tremendously respected and tremendously feared. Because the Pharisees, do you remember the punishment that they could assign you if you made them mad? Remember the man born blind in John chapter 9? What did they do? They put him out of the synagogue. Exactly. It's a formal phrase, apo synagoge, and it was a fearsome thing to be put out of the synagogue. I mean, it was, you don't want to get put out of your local church, but this is something more. Your whole life was wrapped up in that synagogue, and you very possibly weren't going to be able to survive in that community, weren't going to have work, you weren't going to be able to find spouse for your children and so on if you got tossed out of your synagogue. And the Pharisees could do that. So on the one hand, and this is, I didn't mention this, this is so important, I am persuaded that the Pharisees, you know what, in their genesis, in their origin, the Pharisees were a noble people, unspeakably noble. The Pharisees arose in the intertestamental period between Malachi and Matthew when the issue was Hellenization. Are you willing to abandon the law in order to get along with the Greeks and the Romans? And the Pharisees said, no, we will pay whatever it costs us. We are going to be loyal to the law. Is that a good thing? Now, their strategy was this. They said, you know, the law, it's what we were talking about before, the law is not very specific, and so they would surround it with their own specifications. And for instance, they would say that because it's so important not to reap on the Sabbath, we're not going to allow women to look in the mirror on the Sabbath, so we're going to cover our mirrors. Okay, you know what, as far as I'm concerned, help yourself. I don't think that's wrong. We all do that. We all have to make that kind of decision as to how to put you know, be loyal. So I think if you want to say, cover your mirrors, would you agree? There's nothing wrong with that. Help yourself. What happened with the Pharisees is they had these man-made laws that they invented in order to honor the God-given law, and in time they began to regard their man-made law as just as authoritative as the God-given law. And that's not a subjective analysis. I have an acid test to tell whether you've done that, and that is, do you demand others follow your law? In other words, if I say it's wrong to work on a Sabbath, and if you work on a Sabbath, you're wicked. Amen and amen. If I say if you don't cover your mirrors on the Sabbath, you're wicked, I don't have biblical authority for that. See the point? And that became so much their focus, and then they began to trust in those things. And the Pharisees who confronted Jesus had learned to regard the Mosaic law and their man-made accretions to the law as the means by which you please Yahweh. You know what? They were remarkably parallel to official Roman Catholic doctrine. You read Roman Catholic doctrine and they make much of the substitutionary death of Christ. They make much of God's grace in sending his Son. But they teach that God is so gracious that he sent his Son, and the means by which we make that ours is that God has graciously given us the sacraments. Honest to goodness, this is semi-Pelagianism. This is the official doctrine. And that's exactly what the Pharisees taught. God is such a gracious God, and he has graciously given us the law. And now all we need do is keep the law, and God will accept us. That's what Jesus came to confront. You have to understand it. And the Pharisees were the embodiment of that. They gave themselves day by day. They were full-time, dedicated lawkeepers. That's what they did. And if they could find a new little tiny wrinkle by which they could regard themselves as being more faithful to this or that law than anybody else, they jumped on it. Does that make sense to you? So, but in many ways, as I say, in their genesis, they were noble. Now, on the other hand, the Sadducees were the polar opposite. Their area of control was the temple, and their only area of control, and it was theirs because they had purchased it. It was official. They owned it, and they had purchased it because they knew they could make so much money if they controlled the temple. So the Sadducees, usually called in the Bible the chief priests, but this sect, if you don't mind, this leadership subset within Judaism, the Sadducees, basically controlled the temple, and they were functional unbelievers. They were Hellenized. They were Grecianized. They were totally, totally Platonic. That is, they had bought into Platonic, Neoplatonic doctrine. They were dualists. I don't want to get too far in. But what it came down to is they Well, what usually are you talking about in the Bible when the Sadducees are mentioned? What's the doctrinal issue at stake? The resurrection. And what's their position? I don't believe in it. So, I mean, good heavens. Now, it's a little finer. Well, at any rate, the point is you have these men in positions of spiritual leadership who don't believe in spirits. They don't believe in an afterlife. They don't, and they are functional unbelievers. And this is the big one. They are despised and resented, and they don't mind it. Remember I showed you that bridge in that picture? The Sadducees had that built because they lived up on the high western hills that caught the Mediterranean breezes. And they had that built so they wouldn't have to soil their feet with the dust of the common man. They could just make their way across their exclusive bridge into the temple and so on. They had nothing but contempt for the common man and made the most unconscionable merchandise of him. Now, what happens is Jesus comes in on Monday morning, and for the second time in his ministry, he drives the money changers and the... they evidently had set up shop inside the temple. Some think in the courts, some think down in some chambers, but at any rate, and by the way, I didn't make this point, and Josephus goes on and on about this, and so does the Mishnah, about what they call the Bazaar of Annas. Annas was the high priest before Caiaphas. Caiaphas is the high priest when Jesus is tried. And Annas is the father-in-law of Caiaphas. But the point is that what they had determined, I never finished this thought, when you come to Passover, you have to bring a lamb, but you have to have that lamb inspected by the priest. And so the priest just determined that we ought to be able to make some money off of this. So you got all these shepherds bringing sheep up, and if you'll pay us a piece of the action, then we'll accept your lambs. If not, we won't accept your lambs. So they drove the market price up, and in many cases they didn't even pay attention to whether or not the lambs were genuinely Levitical acceptable. The only issue was, did we get a piece of the action? In order to control it more thoroughly, they moved it inside. Does that make sense to you? So you come up to worship, and you're paying above market prices for lambs that very possibly don't even meet the Levitical qualifications, and you know it's all happening because these priests are so rapacious and so greedy and so on. But what can you do? I always say, this is my background, forgive me, you can't go down the street and start the Second Baptist Temple, you know what I'm saying? So you're stuck with this one, and you're stuck with these priests, but the people absolutely despise it. Does that make sense to you? So for Jesus to take a cord and to begin to drive those men off the temple and so on, but he goes further. For 2 days, he totally possesses the Temple Mount. Now, I got to be quick, but let me tell you something. Watch this. I think there is strategy in this. This really comes together if you watch it. There are four Passovers in Jesus' ministry. In John 2, you have the record of his cleansing the temple at the very beginning of his ministry. But then evidently for two Passovers, he plugged his nose. There's no reference whatever. I'm sure it didn't happen. But he does it on the fourth Passover of his ministry. And it's going to take his enemies 5 days to get him on the cross. Now, here's the thing. The Pharisees despise the Sadducees. The Sadducees, the Pharisees. Think about the strategy implicit in Jesus' initial John 2 cleansing of the temple. He comes up. John the Baptist has been ministering for a long time, but kind of under the radar. Now here comes Jesus, and shortly after he commences his public ministry, and it's been quite quiet up to this point. He did go up to a wedding and change the water to wine and so on, but otherwise he's been quite not too much attention paid him. But now he comes to Passover, and he cleanses the temple, folks. The point is, he would have been catapulted into notoriety. This is a Passover feast. People are coming from all over the world. Here's this crazy Nazarene, drives those wicked money changers out of there, and that quick he'd have been the wildly popular folk hero of that people. I mean, and everybody would have gone home talking about it. But so immediately he becomes the only thing that's going to talk about in Jewish circles. But beyond that, watch what happens. When he cleanses the temple, whose turf is he attacking? The Sadducees. But you see, because he made himself so instantly famous and popular, the Sadducees couldn't just grab him and stone him. There'd have been a riot. There'd have been trouble. So, and the people hate the Sadducees. They wouldn't have put up with that. So in order to get rid of Jesus, the Sadducees have to go to the Pharisees. Because the Sanhedrin, that body of self-government, 70 leaders in Jerusalem, ruled over by the high priest, was made up almost evenly, although the Sadducees had a little higher number, but of Sadducees and Pharisees. But see my point? Jesus cleanses the temple, he angers the Sadducees, he delights the Pharisees, and now he ties the hands of the Sadducees. They can't just grab him, and the Pharisees aren't going along. They thought that was the greatest show they'd ever seen. But now, for 2-3 years, Jesus goes from synagogue to synagogue. Now whose turf is he on? See the point? And you watch it happen in the page of the Gospels. The Pharisees, not the Sadducees, but the Pharisees get more and more angry. And I imagine, but Jesus is still popular, by the way, so they can't seize him either. They got to get the Romans involved. In order to do that, they got to get the Sanhedrin involved. But now, don't you suppose the Sadducees were dragging their feet? See the point? They're thinking, hey, he hadn't given us any trouble, and when it was your ox, well, our ox being gored, you weren't anywhere to help. So you're on your own, fellas. You can't say, by the way, Paul learned this. Paul learned to pit the Pharisees against the Sadducees. Remember that? But the point is that on Monday morning of the Passover, Jesus, of the Passion Week, Jesus cleanses the temple for a second time. When he does, he galvanizes the hatred of the Pharisees and the Pharisees have been wanting him dead for a long time. But now the Sadducees are just as angry as the Pharisees. He is signing his own death warrant. That's what I want you to see. This is deliberate. He is galvanizing the anger of the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and it's going to take him 5 days to get him on a cross. Does that make sense to you? There's nothing accidental about this. Some people, it's interesting that in the triumphal entry, Jesus makes his way. Mark says he came in and looked around the temple and returned to Bethany. That's Sunday, and a lot of people say, well, why did he cleanse the temple there? Well, that assumes that this was some momentary peak, you know, that he's just angry, and this was deliberate. That's what I'm telling you. This is deliberate, and I believe, and now Jesus not only cleanses the temple, but for 2 days he possesses it. And as I said last night, Mark says that he wouldn't allow a man to carry. Evidently, you could cut some steps off by going in one gate and across the temple and out another gate, and Jesus would have had none of it. For 2 days, he possessed the temple. I don't know exactly what that looked like, whether he took his disciples and gave them different quarters, but he behaves more messianically than any other time in his ministry for 2 days, Monday and Tuesday. Now, this is where I got to walk you through very quickly, but during those 2 days, I don't have anything. This is on your notes, but let me just tell you very quickly. On Tuesday, Jesus, again, on Monday, he cleanses the temple and drives out the money changers. Then as the day ends, he goes back to Bethany. The next morning, he returns. Again, Bethany is a stroke of genius because it's right off a main road. You're going to have thousands of people coming and going through those gates. Jesus leaves Bethany where he's secure, falls in with those people, comes into the city. His enemies are totally... During the Passion Week, it says again and again, I mentioned before, that they wanted to take him, but they couldn't because they feared the people. But the point is, on Tuesday morning, Jesus returns along the way, sees the fig tree that he had cursed yesterday and so on. But now he returns to the temple and he begins to teach. His enemies are desperate to put a stop to this. More importantly, they're desperate to find something they can use against him. Because I said to you last night that though Jesus had proclaimed himself Messiah all throughout his ministry, he had been circumspect and never used the word in such a way that they could use it against him. And so they're trying. So what happens on Monday and Tuesday, on Tuesday, is that while Jesus is teaching, his enemies come with well-rehearsed challenges trying to catch him in his words. The Bible says this. I wish we could, it's magisterial, the way Jesus responds. But you study those things. Just real quick. Remember, the first ones to come are the Sadducees. Now, I want you to think about this. The Sadducees come, and they ask what seems on the face of it to be a rather innocuous and expected question, and that is, by what authority do you do these things? Please understand, this was a well-crafted trap. What they desperately wanted him... Remember, the Sadducees had title to this area, and it was their business that had been shut down. But they come and they say, by what authority do you do these things? It's a well-crafted question. And what they are desperately hoping is that Jesus will say, what is true, I am Messiah. By what authority? We have Roman authority here. Who is it in the world that has prior authority? The answer to a Jewish ear would be Messiah, right? So they're asking him, by what authority, in the hopes that he will say, I am Messiah, I have a right to this. If he had said that, they would have gone immediately to Pilate, and said, "We got him. He claims to be a king. This is Passover. You can't put up with this." What does Jesus do? This is magisterial. He says, and this is the way rabbis, a rabbinical training school is called a yeshiva, and I have twice gotten into rabbinical orthodox rabbinical schools. It's the most fascinating place, but I'm going to talk to you. But the fact is, this is the way they're trained to reason. You try and catch your enemy, your opponent in a trap. And Jesus responds with a question. He says, remember, by what authority do you do these things? I'll answer you with a question. The baptism of John, was it of heaven or was it of men? Now that seems, at first blush, like a horrible non sequitur, but it is anything but. Because you see, they put their heads together and they say, now wait a minute. If we say that the baptism of John was of heaven, we'll have our answer. We ask, what authority do you have to do these things? If John was genuinely sent by God, he announced that Jesus was Messiah, and if he's Messiah, he certainly has a right to the temple, so we got our answer. But if we say that John's baptism was of men, that he was making it up, these people will stone us. They love John the Baptist. So now they go back. This is all hugely public. This is a heavyweight bout that people are hanging on every word. And now they come back and they say, Master, we have no answer. The place would have erupted, I'm telling you. I always say, you want to prove you're a man in a Jewish setting, put your enemy to silence in open debate. There's nothing more respected. There's nothing that proves your rabbinical authority like your ability to do that. And here Jesus puts them to silence. The next group is the Pharisees with their, do you pay tribute to Caesar? Show me a coin. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar. God, the things that are God. Master, you have done well. And then, oh, that we could go through it. But that whole thing with the Sadducees coming with their little worn out bromide about the woman with the seven husbands and in the resurrection, whose wife shall she be? And he says, you do err not knowing the scriptures. The interesting thing is that the Sadducees really were total unbelievers, but they gave lip service to the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses. And the reason was because they controlled the temple, and one of the books in the Pentateuch is Leviticus that tells you to go to the temple and pay the tithe. And they knew where their bread was buttered, and so they would give lip service to the Pentateuch. And it's curious that Jesus seems to almost be playing by their rules. If you ask me to prove the resurrection from the Old Testament, that's not difficult. You can go to Daniel or Isaiah or Job or the Psalms. If you ask me to prove the resurrection from the Pentateuch, think about it. But I think Jesus deliberately accepts their restrictions, and he takes them to Exodus 3, and he appeals to Moses, what God said to Moses, I am, not I was, but I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then he simply says, you know that God is not a God of the dead, but of the living. And then Luke 20 says this, after that, no man dared ask him any question at all. I mean, that scene where Jesus methodically, as a matter of fact, you have one more questioner in the midst of that, and that's the young man who comes, I think, with not necessarily a pernicious heart, but or a destructive heart, but he comes and he says, what's the greatest commandment? One of the ways in which a rabbi would spread his tail feathers, if you don't mind, would really show off his capacity as a rabbi, is to summarize the law. And it was called, a student would come and he'd say, Rabbi, teach me Moses on one leg. It was a common thing. Teach me Moses on one leg. In other words, in the time that you can balance on one leg, teach me the law. And if you could summarize the law, and I think Jesus does that magisterially when he says, the first commandment is love the Lord your God. The second is like unto it, love the neighbor. On this, the whole law hangs. And you remember that man was enthusiastic. Master, you have answered well. Remember that? There is a conjecture, and it will be that and only that until eternity. But there is a conjecture that I kind of enjoy that we might be able to identify that young man. You know, it might have been a young rabbinical student living in Jerusalem, studying at the feet of Gamaliel at that time. Could have been Saul. I mean, he would have been there. And later on, you remember that Jesus, when he encounters Saul on the road to Damascus, he says, it's hard for you to kick against the ox goads. This may have been one of those ox goad moments when he stood face to face with the Nazarene and put him to the test. And Jesus, but I can't prove that. But at any rate, Jesus also speaks these horrible parables against them about the man who had two sons and the man who gave a wedding feast and the man who had a vineyard, let it out to you know. So in the course, here's the point. I want you to take your Bible and go to Matthew 23. With this, we'll be done for now. Matthew 23, Jesus, the last words that Jesus speaks to this multitude. And you have to understand, there is nothing of import going on in Jerusalem but this. Everybody who can squeeze in is there. They're hanging, I'm sure, from the rafters to witness this remarkable confrontation as this Nazarene who had been identified. The Pharisees had weeks earlier announced that they wanted him dead, but now he rides into the city and the whole city welcomes him as king, and the next day he comes and cleanses the temple, and now he possesses it, and all the leaders have confronted him and he's put him to silence, and now he speaks for the last time publicly. And it is a series of absolutely withering woes against the Pharisees. Now the curious thing, and it begins in Matthew 23, and about 13, I guess, where Jesus begins to speak these, now earlier in that. But notice the woes, for instance, in verse 13. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men. You're not going in. You know, by the way, Edersheim says that one of the ways in which the Pharisees would identify, one of the nicknames they had for themselves as a group is gatekeepers. And they would greet each other, he says, in the marketplace, you know, good morning, fellow gatekeeper, and so on. They were so convinced that they knew the law, that they not only were certain to get into the kingdom, but they were going to be assigned the responsibility of keeping the gate and deciding who else could get in. And for Jesus to stand there, and what I want you to catch, and I'm done with this, he had been fighting with all of those in leadership. He had been contesting all through these 2 days with the Sadducees, but he never mentions the Sadducees. He only pronounces woes on the scribes and the Pharisees. Why? Because nobody loved the Sadducees. Nobody was trying to obey and follow the Sadducees. But the Pharisees were revered by the people, and the Pharisees were teaching the people that the means of pleasing God was to keep the law. And what Jesus is doing here is putting the most careful distance between himself and the Pharisees. Now that's huge in this culture. Does that make sense to you? Folks, real quickly, this was the same tactic in the Sermon on the Mount. Read the Sermon on the Mount. The key verse in the Sermon on the Mount is, unless your righteousness exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you'll never see the kingdom of God. And then you got that whole long, they say unto you, but I say unto you, they say unto you, you've heard it said by them of old, but I say unto you. And finally he comes to the end and he says, and I think I always say, in order to understand either of these incidents, the Sermon on the Mount or this right here, you have to picture Jesus pointing. They say unto you, I say unto you. I think he points at the Pharisees. The Pharisees, you could see them a mile away. Their blue was brighter and their fringe was longer and their turbans were higher. And I think on the Sermon on the Mount now, he points to them and says, there's a broad way. Help yourself. There's a narrow way. You can build your house on the sand if you want, or you can build your house on the rock. Now the point is, Jesus, again and again, when people seem to be willing to accept him, he tests that willingness by simply saying, it's me or the Pharisees. Because number one, the Pharisees represented that work salvation, that going about to establish your own righteousness that was so typical of the Jews. And number two, the Pharisees could make life miserable for you if you abandoned them. So it was a genuine test, and that's exactly what he's doing here. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, again and again. You compass land and sea to make one proselyte. When you make a proselyte, he's twofold more the son of hell than he was in the first place. This is high dudgeon. This is amazing. People's eyes must have just been wide as they listened to Jesus. At one time, he says here, you remember, you strain out a gnat and you swallow a camel. Folks, number one, that is exactly descriptive of the Pharisees, and number two, it's hilarious. I think the place would have erupted with derisive laughter, and meanwhile, those Pharisees, can you imagine the anger? Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, you're like so many whited sepulchres. There was an issue that because most Jews just buried in a cave somewhere in the back 40, some people might be making their way up to the temple for Passover, and they just stop in the shade a little while, and they discover they're leaning up against a tomb, and now they're unclean. And so the scribes, the rabbis, had given a command that at Passover season, all the tombs had to be whitewashed. And interestingly enough, the Temple Mount is lower than the Mount of Olives, and the Mount of Olives is covered with graves. And I picture Jesus maybe sweeping his hands across that horizon to the east and saying, "You're like so many whited sepulchres. You gleam and you look nice, but you're full of dead men's bones." And the whole point is men just brush up against you and they become a stench in God's nostrils. These are not words designed to endear Jesus to the Pharisaic fraternity. Can we agree on that? But they are words designed to drive men to a choice. That's where I'm taking you. And notice how he concludes in verse 33. He says to the Pharisees, "Serpents, brood of vipers, how can you escape the condemnation of hell?" And with a couple of more words, he leaves. Now, it's Tuesday. I asked the question given Sunday, why Friday? I think the answer is Monday and Tuesday, because on these 2 days, Jesus takes the temple to himself. He proclaims himself to be Messiah, and then methodically, having put all of his enemies to silence, he puts the most careful and deliberate distance between himself and the Pharisees, and he says, "You choose." That make sense to you? The city's going to have a few days to think about it, and this is going to percolate through the city. What's going to happen, and we'll talk about this evening after the break, what's going to happen is there's going to be a huge plot laid late on Tuesday to get Jesus arrested, tried, and on his way to the cross before the city wakes up. Because both the Jewish and the Roman authorities have Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday ringing in their ears. And as all they know, when the city wakes up, they're going to be enraged that this favorite Messiah pretender of theirs is now on his way to the cross. That make sense to you? Now, when the city does wake up, they're going to cast their lot with the leaders. And I think the reason is because of Tuesday night. That make sense to you? Honest to goodness. See, I like to say it this way. Now we're going to go eat. These 3 days, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, tremendously instructive. And the grand lesson of Sunday is this. Jesus rides into the city. It is a genuine, loving, honest, qualified offer of himself as deliverer. And Jesus does, in fact, offer himself honestly as the deliverer of mankind. Amen and amen? That's the lesson of Monday, of Sunday. Monday and Tuesday, he possesses the temple, and he drives the most he drives that people to the most deliberate decision between himself and the Pharisees. And the grand lesson of Monday and Tuesday is simply this. Like I say, Jesus genuinely offers himself. But the fact is, you don't take Jesus on your terms. You take him on his terms. And the Jews were happy to have him on their terms. We just want somebody to deliver us from Rome. But Jesus' point is, as long as you cling to Pharisaic self-righteousness, you'll not have me. You don't take me on your terms. That make sense to you? I think it's exactly the case today, obviously. You don't take Jesus on your terms. So it's Tuesday. Jesus goes back to Bethany. We'll pick the narrative up there right after dinner.